The artist Jason Lazarus, whose work sits in multiple permanent museum collections and has been exhibited across the United States and Europe, whose photographic practice bears witness through a multitude of methodologies, very nearly went into a career in marketing. But luckily for the world, he didn't. He was introduced to creative conceptual thinking while simultaneously taking night classes in photography, and that serendipitous combination led him to an MFA in photography and a body of work that is a philosophical exploration of photography. He describes himself as an artist exploring vision and visibility. His photographic practice is less about being the maker than being an organizer, a curator, about seeking new approaches of inquiry, embodiment, and being the keeper of multiple public submission repositories. He is the director of a nomadic sculpture library titled PDF Objects, in which over 100 international artists, so far, have paired a work of text that significantly informs their practice with a low-cost everyday object. He co-founded a national campaign that asks artist educators to think about and document the first image they show to students on that first day in class, to encourage educators to center underrepresented voices from the get-go. And he is the founder of the project Too Hard to Keep, in which he accepts and archives images which have intensely emotional meaning to their owners, images that are too hard to throw away, but too heavy to keep. As well as being the progenitor of multiple ongoing projects, Jason Lazarus is an assistant professor of art and art history at the University of South Florida and one of this year's jurors for the University of Missouri's undergraduate visual art and design showcase. Jason, I hardly know where to start. You have notched up more achievements in your 20-year art career than most artists spend a lifetime accumulating. Has it felt like a whirlwind of activity to you?
Sometimes looking back, yeah, I think in the present, you're balancing ideas, questions, tensions that help keep you alive. And so engaging with those, itching those, trying to problem solve those, give things and feelings forms that can metastasize into relationships. Yeah, sometimes it's this idea of maintaining sort of a focus on the present in order to keep things moving along, not letting previous successes keep magnetizing your research and practice backwards.
Mm.
And, you know, I saw one of your questions was about marketing, and I feel like my background in the Midwest as a sort of nerdy student, I think there was a whole swath of like the humanities and humanities thinking that I didn't have a lot of exposure to until I got to college. So I went into college thinking I would be sort of a creative business person, and marketing seemed like the sweet spot of that. And when I got out of school, I worked at a court theater, which is on the campus of University of Chicago, and that theater has what I would say are kind of contemporary adaptations of classic theater, and the contemporary adaptations had a lot of conceptual thinking. So as the marketing person, I was involved in a lot of the meetings where the director and the costume designer, lighting designer, sound designer were all sort of mapping out their visions and doing these research presentations. And I realized that creativity was more than just sort of this wild goo that I thought it was before. And I started to realize these people are intensely visionary and serious and filled with imagination and discipline. And I didn't really put any of this together till way later, like how that marketing job for a nonprofit theater had a lot of sort of kindling that would help me, I don't know, sort of find the next version of me, which at the same time I was taking night classes in photography really just for fun and because I just felt like my job was taking up so much time, and I wanted to have like one personal thing I was working on.
So you hadn't, as a child or teenager, photography wasn't something that you were interested in. It was something that you really just picked up as an adult and then ran with.
Yeah, when I was in high school, I wanted to be a CEO, and I wanted to go to Wharton Business School at the University of Pennsylvania.
Wow.
Yeah. And it took me a while to realize, it was a beautiful, slow, organic journey about why, what some of the goals from an earlier time didn't have any lasting attraction.
I think it's interesting as you go through life and you're constantly looking forward that sometimes when you, and you don't feel like you've ever had a plan, when you look backwards at things that you've done, it all begins to add up and you see this kind of invisible journey pulling you forward the whole time. And I think for you as an artist, having a background in marketing, when so much of the arts world is about being able to market yourself and being in the right place at the right time. And I see that. I see the vestiges of your degree in marketing in your ability to create these concepts and get the word out and get people excited and involved. Does it feel like when you look back that that marketing degree, like you say, it was the kindling? I mean, that it has really shaped your career as an artist?
I feel like I'm not a very good marketer of my work in ways where when I'm on social media, I see people who are so regular and thorough in their project descriptions and their social media game is really on point. And so I feel like, for example, Too Hard to Keep, which you had a question about, maybe I could talk about the way that that project, I guess maybe how marketing skills are and are not involved in that. And I would say that the way that project started was feeling like I was the kind of person who had images that were too hard to keep, but too painful to destroy. And the prompt for that project is one of vulnerability and kindredness and solidarity and kind of bigger notions of humanity. So I think trying to be sensitive to what my own inner world is and how that might activate other worlds that feel like it just felt like that's something that hadn't been tapped into. And when I sort of ran this idea by friends or asked them if they had something that they would submit, I started getting all these great submissions. And so it's actually pretty easy to post an idea like that online. And when I started that project, that was like a Blogspot project. You know, the blog was like the really sort of initial engine of that. So I kind of feel like it's the poetics of a project like that, which end up doing a lot of the work. I mean, you kind of get it pretty quickly if you're going to get it. Mm. And I kind of just feel like there's an implied economy and there's a level of trust. And I just tried to be really clear about what my contours were as an artist, that the submissions would be shown anonymously and without context. There is like a marketing angle, I guess, in the title of the project, which is technically THTK. But I think one way marketing helped is that I was like, I want the project, like just to talk about the project, you're describing it to someone all at the same time. You know what I mean? So if you're saying Too Hard to Keep, it's like, how can I say this in the least amount of words possible? And this is something I still use, which is, I guess, could be kind of like a marketing exercise. But I also think for an artist, it's just like really helpful. For example, through teaching, I'm always asking students to try to talk about their ideas, sometimes in as few words as possible. You know, I'm asking them to write an artist statement that's like, or project statement that's like 12 words or less, and then maybe like a 700 word version, which if you were applying for a big grant, you sometimes need both of those. So I think it can be really helpful. Like if I had to describe myself as an artist in as few words possible, I would say my work is about vision and visibility. But it's just a way to start to engage in a, what I think is a human way, like getting onto an island or, you know, entering into a field of thinking.
Right. I think you've got to have the, as they say, the elevator speech. Like, how can I explain what I do when I've got your attention for 5 seconds? And if you're interested, then I'll give you the 30-second version. And if you're really interested, we can talk and go for drinks and talk about it more. But you've got to have that hook for people.
Right. And I think as an artist, sometimes you're, especially when you're younger, like your thinking and your making is sometimes like really complicated, and you're also changing as the person a lot. And it's really helpful to treat the ideas that you're working with as a sort of onion, and you kind of try to find your way toward the middle. Once you find the way the middle, then you can like go back out to the edge again. But then sometimes when you get all that language just right, it can also get you stuck. And at least for me, I don't like my narrative to be too tight in what I do, because I don't want to overly simmer in an idea that, you know, fetishize an idea that's kind of like been executed a number of times. And this happens to artists all the time, where you're sort of trying to be a good steward of a project that for you is like maybe where your heart was like 9 years ago. And Too Hard to Keep is also a good example of that. Like if someone wanted me to do that, I think I would be more selective right now in who I work with and in what context, and ask myself, what could I learn and what's the value of this project in the contemporary moment? Because there's an opportunity cost to use business language, right? But it's like you can quickly have your work serving a number of other people or institutions' agendas. And it's a great thing to be aware of.
So on that, the Too Hard to Keep and the ongoingness, I mean, that is a lifetime project that when you set it up, you said this is something that will last forever, and you have a partner in it that would take it over should anything happen to you. So this is huge responsibility that goes with it, and a kind of a burden. Does it feel like a burden at this point? Do you wish that you put a time limit on it, or are you happy that it's going to go as long as you're on the planet?
It's not part of what doing a project like that is about is maybe earlier in my career, I had more things to say, and I feel like I had a different kind of swagger and confidence. And I think as you get older, I started to engage in practices of listening and discovery more. And I think that was a nice shift that I realized also later, you know, to put it in those terms.
Too Hard to Keep feels like a listening project.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's also like something you do when you kind of get bored with making images yourself. Like, I know how to use a camera. I have ideas and habits on how to make a project. And I think I was just looking for things that felt more intimate and connective and bodily. And the installations that come out of that project, like, they don't exist in vitrines. You know what I mean? Like, they're not given museumological armature and protection. Like, you could just take one of the prints off the wall and walk away with it.
Right.
You know, because as an artist, I think it's important to feel, or to ask yourself, what can I do that's not being done already? Like, museums already, their job is to be sort of clinical and exhausting in the way they register everything, and to provide protection. And I kind of think that my mission or value in that project is to have the material feel as vulnerable as the concept that underlies it.
Right. And when I was looking at your images online of those installations you've done with the THTK images, I was fascinated and also a little bit disturbed by them. I was fascinated because there's such elegy and unknown, and this unknown narrative in each one, but disturbing in that, like, I feel like I'm like someone's ripped the last chapter of the book out and I'll never know. And it's not my job to recreate their story for them. So I had this compulsion for the project, which is good, I guess, is what you want your audience to have. But there's also this kind of degree of torture about it too, that I want to open the door and say, well, what happened next?
Right. Well, I think in the early part of the project, I was expecting and surprised by maybe some degrees of spectacle that were in the image. Like, it was clearly a hard photo to look at. But then I also started to become slowly sensitive to, and then increasingly desirous of, very banal images, particularly obscurant, like obfuscating. And, you know, I'm like, well, if I feel this way, perhaps other people will feel this way. And I think the installations, because I've gone through an arc of intimacy with the project, I feel like I try to understand best how to set it up for a viewer. I like, okay, you're going to notice these kind of images first, and then you're going to look at these, and how do I keep the audience moving slow, but like with intimacy and expansiveness, you know, that so they start to see the scope of experience and strategies and the kind of infinity of experiences that we can all tap into.
Well, I could spend an hour talking with you about your THTK project because I think it's an endlessly fascinating rabbit hole. But let's move on to another project I want to ask you about. An installation that was part of a 2020 show called Empathy Fatigue, and also an installation for the Tampa Museum of Art in 2021, and which consisted of 24 sound screen therapy devices, or what I think of as white noise machines, those round plastic containers housing an asymmetrical fan which create the sound of rushing air. They are so familiar to me because I sleep with one in our bedroom, but your installation was centered on the need for solidarity around mental health. Would you talk a little about the background of this work?
Yeah, so I'm really excited for you to ask me about this project. I think this project kind of came out of me pretty quick. So the background of the work is, you know, in my early 40s, not very long ago, I found myself in a really surprising place in terms of mental health, where I felt like I was on the edge of believing in life. And you know, the moments where you go like into like, let's say, a kind of red zone feel so permanent,
right,
and hopeless. So I was in therapy and my therapist had one of these sound screen devices outside her door. And in the process of going into therapy, I'm the kind of person who you get kind of like bored and impatient, but also like staring at the sort of theater of, you know, whether it's the dentist office or a doctor. And in this case, the sound screen device, like it was kind of dumb that I didn't know what it was automatically, but I really was sort of in a mind state where I noticed it and kind of was like looking at it as this sort of, I don't know, safe place, or just, I was like just happy to be entertained by something that looked so weird. And then took me a few sessions until I was like developed a rapport with the therapist and I could ask her about it. I mean, I think I like realized what it was after a few sessions and my thinking was a little bit less clouded and emergency thinking, and I could kind of open up and just, so, you know, she explained that yes, it was a sound screen device and would protect our conversation. And I was like, of course, this makes total sense. So I started thinking about these sound screen devices as metaphors. I asked her if I could buy the one that she has outside her door and replace it with just one off the shelf. And she said that she didn't think that was appropriate, but that she liked the idea and that I should research these and try to not break the sanctity of our context. And I was like, okay, heard. So I bought one online. Like, for a couple of reasons, was because I just wanted to listen to it outside of the context of a therapy appointment. And I didn't really even use it as like a sleeping or calming device at first, you know, which I now do too. I just wanted to have permission to look and feel and play with one. Then I thought, what would it be like to have a number of these going at once? So then I bought three more, and I probably at that point started to buy ones that were used, And of course, they have that pathos. And I was looking for ones that had some sense of wear on them, whether that's little dings or that they were an older model. There's a lot that have sun bleach from just being in the same place over time, which I absolutely adore. So the collection, as I've amassed it, it has new ones. It has ones that are used. I like finding in the forms, like I kind of think of it as a typology, right? It's like a kind of standard form with these little tweaks. And then you have little moments of wear and tear and sun bleaching. And then when I started to play three or four together, I like to think of them, I don't know, as a sort of kindred of companionship, of like solidarity and like of a choir. I also started to realize that when I played them in concert with each other, that they weren't sort of an asterisk outside of a door. They were their own growing body themselves. And so one of the ways I like to think of these collections when I install them is that they become a field of sort of interdependence and solidarity. And we, as individuals, as we walk up, become these little momentary asterisks. And so, yeah, there's so much I love about these things and this project. And I was like trying to task myself with, I think it's really hard to make artwork about mental health.
Yeah.
One of the hardest subjects, like all the really interesting, you know, important subjects are like the hardest to make work about. And I was like, there is room here. Like, this is the way I want to try to engage this subject, which arguably is like in a very elliptical way.
So shifting gears a little bit, because I want to ask you a little bit about the Visual Arts and Design Showcase. A lot of those works are about representation. There are definitely issues of mental health that the students bring up in their work. And so when you looked through the bodies of work in this year's presentation of Showcase, what are some of the things that stood out for you? Some of the ideas that stood out for you? What moved you?
That's such an exciting and hard question. I was thinking about this kind of question. And the VAD Showcase is, it's really fun because I don't get to see in my everyday life applied art as much. So that was wonderful because, of course, there's a lot of overlap in mental health and identity, kind of struggling and exploring identity, ran throughout many of the submissions that we had the pleasure to view. And I think that the subjects that the students take on are incredibly difficult. And we're also in an age, like I can't imagine being what their average age is in the world that we currently live in. I don't even know how to wrap my head around it. And I think the older I get, the more I realize, you know, I learn so much from students. It's very, the student-teacher relationship is very checkerboard. It's like you want it to be sort of a tuning fork or something, or like a choir. And when the students find a crack in an idea where they manage to get to something surprisingly intimate, and maybe the forms that they use to get there are surprising or extra sensitive and embody a kind of personal or cultural or political tension. Like one of my favorite submissions was Brides Dresses for Neurodivergent Brides.
Mm.
And, you know, when I was clicking on the student submission, the first thing you see are brides, you know, a lovely, well-designed bride's dress. And then everything from that moment was about profound execution of care on the part of the maker. And also kind of like, yes, you know, this is not something I've heard of before. There's room for someone to go in and be really thoughtful and careful about what neurodivergent brides might need, how might that look. And so the conversation with that student was really wonderful and impactful on the other juror and myself.
I love that idea of finding a crack in an idea and exploring that. It's so hard when you look from the outside, you think everything that I could possibly think or do has been done before. But to find those cracks, those are the exciting places in the world.
Oh my God, that's what this is all about, Diana. You know, when you asked me at the beginning, it's like, yes, I'm totally interested in cracks. I've created cracks. A lot of the cracks are not very good cracks. Other cracks have had moments where they've had audiences for a minute. And that's what this long arc of exploration is about. That's the addiction.
Well, before we close, I just wanted to ask you about one last thing. You are one of five artists selected to work with Mississippi's Pike School of Art as part of its $60,000 award from the Andy Warhol Foundation for the Visual Arts. Might you give us a little sneak peek into what you are working on for that?
Yes, thanks for asking about that. I'm working on two projects there. One is with a collaborator, Laurencia Strauss. And Laurencia and I, we put together a two-person collective at this point called the Sea Level Rise Architectural Intervention Institute. And we have only done one collaboration previously, which is we put in an abandoned mall in Miami. We marked out where sea level rise would be hitting the mall 100 years from the year that we did it. So we did it in 2018. So we marked around the mall in the year 2118. Given conservative, mainstream, and aggressive climate change models where the water, the sea level would be in the building. And it was quite remarkable and shocking. So Calvin Phelps, the director of the Pike School of Art, asked Laurencia and I to do some kind of sea level rise intervention work. So Laurencia and I are working on that right now. And the Pike School of Art is 423 feet. Above sea level. And so this is a great dilemma because we can't mark easily where the water is going to be in 100 years. And so basically her and I are in a sort of research phase of how we might embody that project. The other project that I'm doing alone was invitation to do some permanent work that has to do with the political context of the Pike School of Art, which right now exists as a decommissioned jail that was built in the 60s to accommodate extra arrests in the civil rights movement that was happening in Macomb, Mississippi. And so after working and researching and frankly being overwhelmed with ideas and the history, I've come up with an idea that right now it's called The People Are the Monument. And that project proposes to take some of the material from the demolition of the jail and basically create in the green sort of lawn area behind the jail some sort of earthen bleacher steps. And so the earthwork is meant to be either a performance space or a space for audience to fill up so they can all then be looking at a performer that's on the ground level. So I'll be working on those earnestly this summer, which I'm really excited about.
Well, there are so many illuminating and thought-provoking rabbit holes in your body of work. And I literally vanished for days. And I feel like some of those projects, when I think about them in months or weeks or years to come, they'll still give me the feels. There's something that kind of sits with you. They don't dissipate. So if anybody else interested, you can find out more about Jason at jasonlazarus.com. There are lots of links you can click on to find out more about Jason's work. And Jason, I really don't feel like I can begin to do justice to your inspirational body of work in our short time together, but I really am truly thankful that you made time to chat about your work today and for all the help you've given to Mizzou for this year's Visual Arts and Design Showcase. So thank you very much.
Oh, Diana, thanks for your questions are really thoughtful. And thank you so much. And thank you to Mizzou and the students. It is not easy to put yourself out there at a young age. And I just wanted to hug everyone because it's just part of the growing pains of like evolving and getting yourself out there and learning. It never stops. It's the same cycle over and over again. And it's great.